and thank you for inviting me. It's been a very interesting and enjoyable day. What I thought I would do in this presentation is to describe and contrast uncertainties in two contentious areas of risk management for environmental hazards that have been very much in the public eye over recent years. And the first of these is the possible risks to health for people who live near to land that is treated with pesticides. And this is a quote from Georgina Downs. It's actually taken from her website, so I can name her. I've had a lot of exchanges with Georgina Downs over many years. One of the things that she says in this statement is absolutely true, that pesticides of their nature are intrinsically more hazardous than most other chemicals because they are designed to be biologically active. And because of that, the use of the sale and use of pesticides in Europe, the United States, and in other developed countries these days is quite tightly regulated in much the same way that medicines are. The aim of pesticide regulation, as stated in European legislation, is that where plant protection products are used in a way that's consistent with the conditions of their sale and use, they must not have any harmful effects on human or animal health, which sounds very good, but of course you can never guarantee that because we will never have complete information. But in trying to pursue that objective, we apply a standardized approach to risk assessment that has been developed over many years, and it's used worldwide not only for pesticides but also for many other chemicals. And essentially it involves defining different exposure scenarios. For example, one might be somebody who lives next to a field that's being treated with pesticides, another might be somebody eating food that are derived from crops that have been treated with pesticides, or an operator who's applying pesticides. And so you define an exposure scenario, you make reasonable upper estimates of daily exposure that might occur in that situation to the chemicals of concern, which might be the pesticide itself, or it might be one of its co-formulants, or it might be a residue derived from the pesticide, and you compare that with a toxicological reference value, and there are different reference values depending on what the scenario is that you're looking at, which is a value that is considered to be a level at which one can be adequately confident, reasonably confident, that adverse effects will not occur, even in the most sensitive people. That's the aim of it. And these reference values may occasionally take into account data from human studies, but for pesticides, in the large majority of cases, they're derived principally from animal studies. And essentially, you have a whole range of different animal studies. So pesticides, we still have two carcinogenicity bioassays, different species, but there's a whole range of different studies, and you're looking at what's the critical endpoint that occurs at the lowest level in any animal species, and then you apply assessment factors to that to take account of some of the uncertainties in extrapolating from animals to humans, and also because some humans may be more sensitive than others and you want to allow for that. So typically you might apply an assessment factor of 100. So you're aiming for a level of exposure that is less than 1/100th of the highest level that doesn't cause any detectable adverse effects in animal studies. And the risk assessment approach is a tiered approach. So particularly on the exposure side, we may start with models that will tend, if anything, to overestimate exposures, perhaps quite a lot in some cases, but provided those conservative models come up with an answer that is less than the toxicological reference value, then the risk assessment is considered acceptable. If it doesn't, then it may be open to the applying company to generate better data which give more accurate information about what levels of exposure would actually occur. So that's the sort of broad approach, and it is quite a standardised approach, and there is a need to have a fairly standardised approach because it has to be understandable. It needs to be understandable by people who are applying to get pesticides licensed. They need to know what sort of evidence of safety they have to produce. It needs to be understandable by the public as well, if possible, so that they understand how decisions are made. And also, there is, a value in having a consistency of decisions between different chemicals. So you don't want to apply different criteria for one chemical from another, if possible. But it's certainly not a perfect system. And it does evolve all the time as new scientific information becomes available, and also as public values change. And the tendency has been for the system to become progressively more precautionary over the years, so that increasingly companies are required to provide more positive evidence that harm will not occur from use of a product than they used to in the past. I've listed here some of the main sources of uncertainty. I'm sorry about spelling sources. It must be this Apple computer that arise in this sort of risk assessment, risk management process. Some of them, as I say, are already addressed by the application of assessment factors. So extrapolation from animals to humans, and variation between individuals. The factor that is applied, the two tenfold factors, it relates to the fact we've got 10 digits on our hand, I think. We count in tens, and it was fairly arbitrary when it was first introduced decades ago. Fortunately, empirical data since then suggests that it's actually not that unreasonable, that it seems to work fairly well. There are some chemicals that will show bigger variations in toxicity between species than tenfold, but for most chemicals it covers it most of the time. And of course, by having two factors that are multiplied by each other, you get some added security, because you have to be doubly unlucky for the 100 to be unsatisfactory. There's quite a lot of uncertainty in the way in which we model exposures and combine, because people can be exposed in various different ways. If you take, for example, dietary exposures, then you need to have information about patterns of dietary consumption in the population. You need to have information about levels of residues of pesticides that will occur in different foods, and then you have to combine them in some way to get an idea of how much an unlucky high consumer might take in a day, and then you have to make assumptions about how that might apply day on day as well. And so there are uncertainties about the way in which we model exposures, and particularly for the situation that I'm focusing on here, people living next to fields sprayed with pesticides. The data sets that are used to estimate the exposures are often rather limited, so there are statistical uncertainties in the underpinning data. And the last bullet point, which is a bit obscured there, is the question that arises about so-called cocktail effects, so cumulative exposures to multiple pesticides. Might they pose risks over and above those that you get from chemicals in isolation, and aggregated exposures where you've got the same pesticide but you're actually exposed to it not only by working as a pesticide sprayer but by living next to fields that are sprayed and by eating food as well. And it's in the last 10 years really, regulatory authorities have started to address that problem. It's not easy to do. And one of the challenges is that if you start to make allowance for multiple sources of exposure or exposure to multiple different pesticides, and if you try to adopt conservative assumptions at every term, you very, very soon get to a position in which everything's totally unreasonable, that everything's far too worst case. And it's how, the challenge is how you deal with that. The approach on that particular problem that's beginning to come into use is a probabilistic approach, and that's probably easiest to understand in relation to the exposure side. So you can model distributions of exposures from different sources probabilistically based on empirical sampling. And then you can combine them together to get estimates of distributions of exposure from all sources. But there are problems with that as well, because the models that are used may not be valid. There are assumptions of statistical independence that may not be valid. So the fact that you're exposed to one pesticide in your apples may make you more or less likely to be exposed to another in apples as well. The fact that you eat one sort of food means that perhaps you're less likely to eat another sort of food. And at the moment, the data that we have don't fully allow us to take that into account. It's also very time-consuming and expensive to do that sort of analysis. And there are challenges in defining what is an adequate level of protection for the population. And it's... depending on how you do the sums, you can make, even if you talked about the probability of an adverse effect from somebody spraying the field next to your house on a day, and if you say, well, that's 0.0001, but then you think of how many people there are in the country who live next to a field that's sprayed with the pesticides on different days of the year, and then you soon start getting to quite large numbers of people who might be adversely affected. So that there are challenges there in what's an adequate level of protection. And I think problems also with spurious precision, particularly when you get to the extreme of distributions, and there's a problem if people interpret things without understanding that. So how you explain things to the public is a challenge if you're using that sort of risk assessment. So that's just a brief run through some of the challenges from uncertainty in risk assessment for pesticides. And the main message is that this is a system that's actually been evolving over a period of time and is relatively well standardized. Second problem I want to talk about is the risks or possible risks to health from mobile phone technology, which, you, as you know, has grown from nothing to an enormous scale over a very short period of time. And it's been important to think about whether there might be risks to health from uses of mobile phones. The main exposures that you get are actually from using the mobile phone, sticking it to your head. People tend to worry more about the exposure from base stations because they don't see the concomitant benefit from having a base station, a mast, nearby, although actually the exposures you get are orders of magnitude lower from the base stations than they are from the phones themselves. And another challenge in risk management in this area is that the technology is continually evolving. So even over the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen changes from, you know, the different generations of phones and the fact that you now have a... Well, I don't have one, but I've seen people playing with them today where you get your emails and things. Somebody's probably looking at them now while I'm talking. They use different frequency bands, different signal characteristics. So it's not all exactly the same. the aim of regulation, again, would be to prevent harmful effects on human health. But the problem is that at the moment, there is only one well-established hazard from radio frequency radiation of the sort that's used in mobile phone technology, and that's the heating effect, same as happens in a microwave oven, and it depends on the power of the radiation. Now, the exposure response is well understood, and mobile phones are designed in such a way that the heating effects are well below those at which you would have any concerns for human health. The fluctuations in temperature that might occur in tissues are less than, well below the variations that occur over the course of a 24-hour period anyway. So here, the uncertainty is about whether there are unknown hazards, whether there are unknown adverse effects. And we have much less experience to fall back on because the technology is so new. And so the approach has been to seek evidence for other possible adverse effects, combining information from a whole lot of different scientific disciplines. So biophysics, looking at the mechanisms whereby radio frequency radiation might interact with tissues, might have just biological effects, let alone harmful effects. Studies carried out in the laboratory, both in vitro and in living animals. So if you irradiate cells with radio frequency radiation, being careful not to overheat them, do you get mutations in genetic material? Do you get genetic damage? If you irradiate animals, do you get changes in their physiology or in their behavior? And human experiments in the laboratory as well, so psychological experiments, measuring things like blood pressure and levels of hormones and looking for effects on EEG and evoked potentials, those sorts of studies. And then observational epidemiology, of which there's been quite a lot by now and more continuing. But there are challenges in doing that. The methods for carrying out tests in vitro and in animals are much less developed and much less standardized than they are for chemicals. And there are many more dimensions to the way in which you can carry out or deliver an exposure. So for a chemical, you have the dose level per day and the number of days over which you give it, and you can also deliver it by what you can mix it with the food, or you can put it down a tube into the animal's stomach. But for a radiation exposure like this, you can vary the power. And the number of days over which you expose the animal, but you can also vary the frequency and the signal characteristics with the frequency. And the problem then is that you get one positive study published in Bioelectromagnetics, and unless you attempt to replicate it using exactly the same exposure system, then people will say, well, can you be sure that the difference isn't because it's a different exposure? It's not really being refuted. And so inevitably, when there's so much research going on, there will be some positive studies. And part of the effort has actually been trying to replicate the ones that look most suspicious. And where that's been done, they haven't been replicable to date. So problems with exposure characterization, and then in the epidemiology there are standard problems of bias and confounding. A good example of bias would be studies which have looked at the risk of brain cancer retrospectively in relation to which side of the head people hold their mobile phone, and if you look at the results from those studies, there's a fairly strong overall tendency to find increased risks of brain cancer on the same side of the head as people say that they hold their phone, but actually you find a reduced risk of brain cancer on the other side of the head, and almost certainly there is some biased reporting, biased recall, because people know which side their tumour is. And you know, if you ask me which side I hold the phone, I'm not sure actually I could tell you which side of my head I hold the phone. So there are all these different sources of uncertainty. The bottom line at the moment is, in the view of most of the committees across the world of good scientists who've reviewed evidence, and it gets reviewed at regular intervals, the sum of evidence at the moment doesn't point, even with strong suspicion, to any identifiable hazard from mobile phone technology or from the radiation from mobile phone technology. We know there's a hazard from using mobile phones while driving, which incidentally is for hands, is not just for handheld, it's for hands-free as well. It's from the psychological distraction. But not a hazard from the radiation. And the main continuing area of uncertainty is about possible long-term risks, because if there were a long induction period before a cancer started to appear, because the technology hasn't been around that long, particularly the newer types of technology, we wouldn't know about it yet. So that's a major driver in the continuing research that's being done. Coming back to the statements I showed at the beginning of the two sections, both of them refer to adverse things happening to people's health. People who are exposed to these hazards do get ill, some of them. And some of the illness that people report and worry about almost certainly is just chance coincidence. I mean, the exposures are very common and illness is very common. So if people say, oh, three people in our village got cancer within 5 years of a mobile phone mast being put up, well, that's going to happen in some villages anyway. But there are other effects that occur, and they're real illness, and they occur in close temporal relationship to exposures, and they almost certainly are caused by the exposures, but they may not be caused by a toxic effect of the exposure. They may arise through what we call nocebo effects, which are really the reverse of placebo effects, and like placebo effects, they can be quite strong. So you can have adverse health effects, which may actually have physical manifestations, but occur through psychological mechanisms. And there are strong reasons to believe that these can have make quite an important contribution to illness that people attribute to these sorts of hazards. One strand of evidence, although it's not persuasive on its own, is that the patterns of illness that people report don't fit with any known toxicological mechanisms of disease. Interestingly, we can show that psychological characteristics and health beliefs will predict later illness. So there was a nice study that was done in New Zealand some years ago, in which baseline information was collected from a general population in a survey. Subsequently, an aerial pesticide spraying campaign was carried out. It was to control a moth of some sort, but they were spraying aerially in the area. And after that, they went back and asked people whether they'd experienced symptoms which they attributed to the spraying campaign. And the two strongest predictors of who got symptoms when the spraying took place were, first of all, whether people complained of other symptoms at the baseline survey. So some people are more aware of physical symptoms anyway. But the other major predictor was a score on a set of questions that was designed to assess people's concerns about modern technology. So people who said that they were worried about GM foods and about fluoride in drinking water and a whole lot of things like that were much more likely after the event to report having had symptoms that they attributed to the pesticide spraying. There's quite a body of evidence that psychological factors predispose. And then perhaps the most convincing evidence in relation to mobile phone transmissions is that there have now been 30 or more blinded, randomized experiments in which people who believe themselves to be sensitive, electrically electrosensitive, have been exposed to real or sham mobile phone radiation in a standardized system. And there have been meta-analyses of the results of these experiments. And the bottom line is that people who claim to be electrosensitive get more symptoms than people who don't claim to be electrosensitive, but they get their symptoms when they think they're being exposed and not when they actually are being exposed. And that, I think, is quite a powerful indicator that these sorts of nocebo effects do occur and have an important role in these sorts of problems. So that's really all I had to say. I'm highlighting some of the problems we face. Of course, they're big topics, but it might be something to stimulate discussion.